Beauty Unplugged, the podcast. Hi, everybody, to another episode of my podcast, She Unplugged. When I started my podcast, my main intention was to bring people into the podcast you can learn from, to tell their stories and to see what they've learned on their way of transformation, career change, personal difficulties, overcoming problems. That was my intention right at the beginning. And that's my intention still today. And today I'm bringing somebody into my podcast who I hope and believe a lot of you can benefit from. Claire is a neurodiversity coach. And one of the questions I will be asking her is that neurodiversity, what is that? And why is that important to the management, to companies, to organizations, to you as a private listener? Claire says that her motivation to get involved with neurodiversity stems from her private situation of having two sons, she says, who have faced barriers to achieving their potential because they are atypically wired. Now, again, I'm going to be asking her, well, is there typical wiring of our brain, and what is an atypical wiring of our brain, and how does that show up in everyday conversations? How does it show up in the workplace? Is there something we need to know about how to communicate with atypically wired people? And the final sort of like intention for me in this conversation is that Claire is very, very adamant in saying that people with atypical brains have a lot of strengths. They have amazing gifts to bring to the table. And I want to ask her how we can benefit from that. So that's going to be my conversation today with Claire, and I'm looking very much forward to it. Like I told you guys, I'm having Claire in my podcast today, and now I have the right person to ask about all the questions that I have in my mind. But first of all, let us welcome Claire to the table. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Anya. Thank you so much for inviting me onto this. I feel very privileged. Thank you.
You're very, very welcome. So I've already talked a little bit about you and what you do, and kind of like my very first question is, you call yourself a neurodiversity coach. Mm-hmm. What is actually neurodiversity?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, because there's lots of language and terminology around this. So let me provide you with as good as an explanation as I can. In essence, people who are neurodiverse interpret information in ways that are different from the majority of the population. Conditions include autism, sometimes known as Asperger's, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD or ADD sometimes, dyslexia, dyspraxia, Tourette syndrome, and there are more. And the key thing to note about people who are neurodiverse is they tend to virtually always have pretty outstanding strength in some areas, things like lateral thinking, perhaps innovation, attention to detail. Not everybody's got all of those, but there's some examples. Yet, here's the rub, at the same time, these same individuals have quite major challenges in areas that the rest of the population don't find so much of a problem. Things like how much information they can take in and process all at once. What happens is, you can imagine somebody has got perhaps a lot of creativity, a lot of expertise, a lot to offer the world, yet they're trying to, if you like, cram that into a funnel. It's like a traffic jam, And there's a frustration coming in there, which can cause challenges in the wrong environment or without the right support. So some of the disability, if you like, is about the environment they're in rather than an innate, which is what for many years the experts would say, there's something wrong with this person. That's not true at all. It's different. Does that help?
It helps. And I think one of the last sentences I want to underline, it's not that there's something wrong with that person.
Correct.
Something different about that person.
Yes.
Now, I know from what you've given me in preparation of today's conversation that you have also sons who had difficulties. Can you share maybe one, two examples of where you and your family struggled with certain situations?
When you discover that your child is different, you're almost going through a kind of a grieving process because it's not the child you thought you'd have. I mean, eventually what you understand is all the strengths there, but it's quite a hard transition to make. So, for example, I'll tell you about, and he won't mind, my middle lad, around about age 10, he was diagnosed eventually with Tourette syndrome. Honestly, we went round the houses with this. We thought he had some kind of allergy and something to do with his throat because he kept coughing. And Tourette syndrome is where you have involuntary tics. They can be vocal or actually involve movement. Very rarely actually involve what the media think is prevalent, which is swearing. That is quite rare. And the challenge is that you can suppress these tics for a while, but not forever. So there's a lot of stigma and misunderstanding. People think, oh, well, they're doing it on purpose. But that also affects how you process information in the brain. And to add to that, we then discovered he had attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And then very recently, as an adult, he's had a diagnosis of autism, or what would have been known as Asperger's, what people would have said was high functioning autism. So it's an awful lot for him to be dealing with, but he has so many strengths. He's got a lot of capacity. But it's just been such a challenge over the years. I've spent a lot of my time trying to help teachers understand what's going on, and they're well-intentioned. It's not that they were deliberately not understanding. So as a young boy, he would be always at the front of the classroom with his hand up, quite a lot of impulsivity in there. And also the teacher would start a lesson, and my son would be wanting to go from a different angle. He found something really, really interesting. I mean, that's the need for that dopamine hit that if you've got ADHD. So quite hard to manage in the classroom, but a lot of curiosity and thirst for knowledge, really hard to manage in a classroom. So he's had some real challenges, lots of bullying as well, despite the best efforts of the school, because, you know, children and teenagers don't like the difference. They can feel threatened by it. He can hold his own much more now, but very challenging. But wow, has he got abilities.
I think that that's really good, because it's those examples that we can relate to. The person I talked to, whose son has now been diagnosed, she also experienced a lot of challenges talking to teachers, looking at him as not somebody who doesn't want to learn, who's just not spending enough time to try, or is not trying hard enough, or, you know, she knows her son, and she knew how much time and effort he put into learning that, and the teachers only saw it from one angle. In practical terms, how did you go about educating the teachers of your sons, and/slash how would you suggest for others to do it in a similar way?
That's an interesting question, because I don't think I did it very well to start with, because I didn't have the understanding of neurodiversity. So I suppose that would be my first point. Read all you can, understand how the brain is different. You can look at things like, and if you want to get really technical, verbal reasoning and perceptual organization, those are things which people who are neurodiverse can often have real strengths in. So how they can use vocabulary, or how they can see in pictures, for example, and be creative and solve problems like that. But at the same time, having a low processing speed, as I said before, that's a bit of a logjam there, and working memory as well. So that's not short-term memories. How much can you deal with all at once in front of you? And once you understand that, it's then easier to demonstrate to the teachers that this child is really curious for knowledge and for learning. It's just that in the classroom situation, there's a lot of information coming in. They can get, can happen with dyslexia as well, distracted, and then the impression can be given that they're not bothered. Or girls especially, what can happen is, rather than the what we tend to think of as, for example, ADHD, boys bouncing around the classroom and causing a problem, quite often with girls, it's more of a daydreamy situation because they've got interested in something else. Plus the fact, even today, girls are more socialized, so it gets masked. We can come on to that in a minute. So it's about helping the school understand how else can they engage your child. It is difficult when you've got a big classroom, but if you can get that right and the child feels valued and validated and can then go off on their own path perhaps and maybe do some research or all sorts of things you can do. I would just say arm yourself with knowledge.
And I think once you have that knowledge, you can also educate others in simple terms. And I fully understand the challenges in the classroom. I mean, in my daughter's classroom, there were at times nearly 30 kids. It's very, very difficult, obviously, for the teacher, you know, to pay attention to those special needs. However, and we will come to that later, it's amazing when we manage to do that.
I suppose the other thing to bear in mind is I always go on the basis that everyone's got a backstory. Those teachers are doing the best they can. If you can genuinely, with good intention, demonstrate that you understand some of those pressures and what you're wanting to do is help both your child and the teacher, that can make a big difference. I have seen parents sort of go in like all guns blazing, and I can understand why they're furious that their child isn't getting what they need, but it doesn't necessarily get you any further.
I mean, in any kind of conflict or challenging situation, if you go in there barging, knowing it all, it usually just causes some confrontation. And what you actually want is communication. You want cooperation, you want to open the door for a maybe slightly different way or whatever solution finds itself then.
I would just add also another thing that's come into my mind now is that ask the child, if you're talking to the sometimes we go over the child and don't investigate. Quite often, or mostly people, if you ask them the right questions, even children know what would be best for them. So for example, the son that I talked about, quite a hard time, especially with his Tourette's as a teenager. And the teacher said, well, he doesn't have to come into assembly then, because you can imagine how embarrassing it was for him if he had a cough. But you know what? He didn't want not to go into assembly. He didn't want not to be part of what was going on. So he made that decision to keep going. So it's very easy to assume we know. We don't usually or often.
Or it's even a trying out. A seeing, well, I don't want to be excluded from the assembly. I try it. How does it feel when it happens in assembly? Because I probably think, oh my God, I hope it doesn't happen now. And then making your own decisions going from there. It's I think it's trial and error very often. Mm-hmm. And you are allowed to change your mind and say, well, I thought it would be that way, but let me just try this way now. But the story of how you got involved in neurodiversity doesn't end with your son, does it now? Because you started on your own path.
It was during, all three of my sons are neurodiverse, if you like, in some ways. There's Tourette's, there's a bit of dyspraxia, a bit of dyslexia. All of these I can provide later, actually, in a handout in terms of what they mean. But it was probably about 10 years ago, and we were talking to a consultant up in London. And I was listening to some of these traits and some of the things that are typical, if you like, of children and people who are neurodiverse. And I started thinking, well, hang on a minute. I've got half of those. And I asked a question, is there any kind of genetics in this? Yes. And I said, do you think there's any kind of possibility? I've been thinking for a while now, maybe, that I am neurodiverse in any way. And they said, well, most likely, yes. So that got me thinking. I did quite a lot of research. I then went to my doctor. I mean, it'll work differently in different countries, but I had to go through my doctor. And I said, look, I'm sure this isn't true. I've done this research, but it won't apply to me, will it? But do you think I might have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder? Most likely, he said. Oh, I said, right. So anyway, from that, then I got referred. And that was a whole other journey, because finding a specialist, it's no mean feat. It's a diagnosis with a psychiatrist. You can't just suddenly say, I'm this. Finding a psychiatrist who understood how it might play out in women and girls was really quite hard. My research journey took me via the United States back to the UK again. I approached one person and they sent me an old photocopied questionnaire designed for children. I thought, no, this isn't going to work. So I did some more research and found somebody absolutely fantastic who understood those nuances, as I kind of alluded to earlier. So that's how I ended up with my diagnosis well into my 50s, or about mid-50s. And it was quite hard to process to start with, but I'm so glad I've had it, because I understand now who I am, what my strengths are, and I've been able to reframe, if you like, all those things that over these, although I was successful, I had this kind of lurking, I'm going to be found out any minute. And it was quite hard work to be successful. So it's just so liberating to understand that. So it's never too late to be able to really look at where you can make a difference.
So it's really having to find a psychiatrist.
It probably works differently in different countries, but certainly in the UK, a GP, a general practitioner, won't be able to diagnose, because it is specialist. There's lots of criteria you have to meet. So that's why it's quite interesting, this debate about, oh, there's no such thing as ADHD, it's just bad parenting. I've heard that quite a lot. It's just absolutely not true. I'm not saying that perhaps sometimes children are diagnosed wrongly, I don't know. And I'm not saying that parents don't get it wrong sometimes, but it's much more complex than that. So you need to get it looked at properly, especially if you're considering medication, which I did, and I am now on. I wasn't quite sure to start with, but it has made a big difference. So, yeah.
First of all, find yourself somebody who can professionally diagnose it. If that's not a psychiatrist, but don't go, look around. That's, I think, what I usually say. Yep. When I talk about therapy or finding a coach, I always say it's rarely that I go into a shop, see a pair of trousers on display and just buy them. I would try them on, and very often I don't like them, so I put them back. And I find with a therapist, with a coach, it is vitally important that if you are not 100% sure about the person, keep looking around, keep asking friends. I'm sure there are Facebook groups,
there are lots
of internet sites. Yeah, exactly. Get your advice, go around, shop around. I need to be 100% sure about that person, especially, and that was the other point when you think about medication, you know, you really, really, really want to be sure that you trust that person, you have a good rapport, yes, and it works.
And you want to find someone that understands the strengths-based approach, because really we're still to a large extent in that kind of medical model of we've got all these different conditions and it always begins with what's wrong. And not all of the medical professionals have shifted over to, okay, what can be good about this? So that is important.
What qualities does your middle son bring due to his neurodiversity?
That's another great question, because he has several neurodiversities. There's quite a lot involved there, and sometimes they kind of bump up against each other. But from an ADHD point of view, he is very creative. He's like me. And you'll probably notice now that I'm looking up, he'll have pictures in his head all the time. And he can, and I can too, see the connections between different concepts and ideas that other people can't see. He's got a lot of energy. So when he's interested, and that's important to note, when he's really motivated, something really interests him, boy, can he go deep and get really in-depth specialist knowledge about something. He has a lot of empathy. People think, as I described, that he also has autism. People can also think, oh, people with autism, they don't have any empathy. Just not true. There are some people who find it very difficult to express that. But ordinarily, just human beings like the rest of us, they feel it. More about how that's expressed. So if you have a lot of empathy, you can spot what's going on for other people. Very, very useful in the team. There's lots more, but that's and his ability to understand processes and technical information. You might not be surprised to know that he graduated in computer science.
And that moves us beautifully to actually where your work takes place, because now we looked a lot at the challenges at school, at the challenges with our children, but when you're working with people, these are now the people in the workplace as a neurodiversity coach. Who is usually coming to you for the coaching? Is it usually the person with the neurodiversity, or is it the manager or the team leader who has an apparent problem in the team?
It varies. It's a combination. Some people who are neurodiverse are a little ahead in their journey, if you like, and they realize it and they research and they work out, okay, I think this is what's going on. They may already have a diagnosis. Then they'll understand, certainly in the UK, with our disability discrimination, employers have a duty to put in place reasonable adjustments to make sure that anyone who has a disability, and in this case, looking at neurodiversity, which is often very hidden, is able to work at their best. Sometimes they'll know about, there's a scheme in the UK run by the government called Access to Work, which will help employers fund some of that. So sometimes it comes through that route. Sometimes it'll be, you're right, a manager thinking, well, I've got this person in my team. I can see they've got strengths, but, well, it's just not going very well at the moment. And I'm not sure if I'm helping. I don't know what to do. What I'm doing is sometimes working just directly with the person who's neurodiverse, and then through that route, helping them to educate and converse with their managers so that everybody can work at their best. Sometimes it's coming through the other route. It's the other route through the manager. It's very much about, well, what we have to facilitate probably first is a conversation between you and your employee, because so often people are managers and entrepreneurs, business owners, are afraid to have that conversation because they genuinely don't want to upset anyone, or they don't want to be, they think they might be accused of discrimination. Whereas actually, without the conversation, without engaging the person who may or may not be neurodiverse, you just can't move it forward.
If I was a manager in that situation, my question would be, how can I help you to bring out your strengths to the team? What do you need from me that our communication is better, or that you feel better? Or I think that's at the center for me. Can you give us a couple of examples where you worked either with a manager or with the employer, and how that played out over time and the situation in the team changed?
Sure. But just before I do, there's another thing that's come to mind, which is really important. In an ideal world, we wouldn't even have to be having this conversation. You'd be developing cultures in workplaces where everybody knew how to work out how they work at their best, and neurodiversity wasn't seen as anything very separate. Where we really want to get to, it's a bit of a dream, is where it's much more systemic. Absolutely anyone who's neurodiverse that I've worked with comes from this base of having sometimes many, many years of believing that they're not good enough, believing that they're slow or lazy. And even if they don't quite believe that, it's hard to unlearn some of that thinking, because as children and young adults, what you do is you believe what people in authority tell you. And even if they haven't meant it like that, that's what ends up kind of sticking. So I'm going to give you an example. I'm working with a senior nurse. She works with dementia patients, and her job is to try and keep them out of hospitals. Even more important at the moment, to keep them at home in their familiar environments. She's recently had a diagnosis of autism. She's in her late 40s. And for her, knowledge is really, really important. She came to me saying, well, my problem is I'm just too slow. My manager's concerned that I'm spending too long doing my preparation. And she was also finding that when she had to go and visit a patient's house, she was stressed about finding the place and lots, very overwhelmed all the time. Once we talked through and understood how the brain works in a bit more detail and what can happen with stress levels if you're overwhelmed, and if you exacerbate that feeling that you can't do it, kind of just, it's like a vicious circle, it gets worse and worse and worse. Once she understood that, and then also started to understand her autism, we worked with a few models, one of which I called kind of forensic questioning. Let's really look at how you work, and is it bad? So we took the example of the preparation she does before she goes in to see her patients for the first time, which is very thorough. So she goes into those patient visits having a really thorough understanding of their patient history, of what's going on, the medication they've been in. So she is able to form a working diagnosis really quickly. So to cut a long story short, what we understood in the end was that actually is saving her time when she then talks to the doctor, when she's liaising with consultants, and when she puts in the management plan, how to move forward to support this patient. So the combination of being less stressed because, well, this is how I am and I've got strengths, and understanding her need for clarity and structure once she kind of sorted that out, plus seeing, well, hang on a minute, it isn't slow. Actually, she became quicker because she wasn't dealing with that stress, because the stress is another sensory input. We haven't really talked much about sensory overload, but it's, you know, dealing with all of those perceptions about yourself. You think someone else is judging you, does not help your performance. So interesting, because her manager was more concerned about her overworking, So she is having that conversation. But the other amazing thing is that she's now going to be applying for a promotion. Now, over the last 10 years, she hasn't applied for anything because she's been worried she wouldn't be able to deal with it. And now she's now really clear about where her strengths are, and she's going to be, these are new roles. So first of all, she's understanding she might be able to shape that role. And secondly, she's going to be talking about how she works at her best. So maybe doing different things on different days, having certain structures, managing the workflow in a different way. She said to me, it's like a whole complete weight off her shoulders. And that's in quite a short time. Sometimes I think to myself, well, I haven't told her any of that. But then I remind myself that I'm able to hold that space, listen without judgment, because if you don't know about neurodiversity, you can, without realizing, kind of judge in terms of, I know how to fix that, and allow her to find the answers, which she already had. It's just that nobody asked her the right questions.
That's really beautiful. And the sense I'm getting is it has that warm, loving, caring, underlying tapestry is the giving you the time you need to find your way. And you said it without any judgment from you as a coach. And that feels like, I don't know how it felt for her, but imagining me coming to you having that conversation, it's just that weight off the shoulders.
That's pretty much what she did. Like that, because you see, I know what it's like to be judged, and people don't do it intentionally.
How do you support, how do you carry people who might be 40, 50, 60 and have been told all their lives there's something wrong with them and they can't do it? How do you get them from reframing their challenges into their superpowers?
That's a good question, because the longer you're carrying this, the harder it can be to make that shift. And there's no good somebody like me just saying, well, hang on, didn't you know you've got superpowers? It depends who they are. It really does depend on that, of unpacking it in real life. Let's really look at this. I mentioned that kind of forensic questioning model I looked at, and using live examples, what's happening to them now, to illustrate where those strengths are. And as you mentioned earlier on, there's a bit of, even with children, it's the same with adults, a little bit of trial and error. Well, I'll try this strategy. Let's see what happens and observe. And sometimes just letting that settle. There's a bit of a tendency or pressure sometimes, if you're coaching, I'm sure you'll understand this, to, well, let's get results really quickly. But sometimes you need to really roll with what isn't working to highlight what could be working instead. I never start with all, well, what's not working, but depending on the person, you might need to work with that. But that is the foundation. Once you understand your strengths, then you can start recognizing them, and it's a bit like a toolkit. Then getting it clear, what are those? So, okay, I'm in a situation now. I mean, even, you know, I am well versed in all of this, but I'm also human and I also have my challenges. So if I kind of verge off into overwhelm, which sometimes doesn't take much, at least now I can, I can accept that's how I am, but it doesn't need to stay like this. I can bring it back.
How much of your work is connected to changing mindset, to connecting belief systems? Because I'm wondering now, when you've been told, going way back, you know, you're stupid, you're dumb, you can't do that, you know, over and over again, it does create an identity. It does create belief systems. So how much of your work is not only to finding the superpowers and finding out what works, but also changing and working on those negative beliefs?
Quite a lot. It depends on the person, because I mean, I'm sure you work with positive thinking and affirmation and really, you know, working in the present tense and understanding the brain will work with what's most prominent. That doesn't work for everyone. Sometimes you need to just get much more concrete and just keep going over, well, you know, what's working. Sometimes it is about then that person explaining to someone else. That's another way of embedding it. So sometimes I'll get into situations where then I'll be the facilitator of a conversation between two people, a person who's neurodiverse and their manager. And that can be, well, life transforming, really. I was working with one person, let's say she's in a human resource role and she had lots of ideas, and her manager was very much more linear and, if you like, spreadsheet orientated. Nothing wrong with that, that's how his brain worked. And the organization professed to be very caring of its employees, and that was his intention. But the conversations they were having, the person I was coaching just felt kind of pushed down all the time and dismissed. So we had quite a brave conversation between the three of us. How did they each work at their best? And what happened was her manager had a bit of a light bulb moment. I hadn't realized these comments, what they could be doing. But because he was very unpracticed, if you like, actually demonstrating that and explaining that, she went down that mindset route of, he didn't think I'm any good. And that was a turning point for her. And actually, as a result of that program of coaching, she's now decided to go and do some further study with the backing of her manager. And she has just dyslexia. She would never have wanted to do that before because she didn't think she could.
That's also a beautiful example that it basically takes both sides, the neurodiverse person and manager or employer on the other side, to create an understanding how we can work together. And in me, there is some part saying, well, we're all on that spectrum. We're all kind of neurodiverse in one way or another, or in certain situations or others. And for some, it's just more frequently and more elaborate and stronger than for others. But
right, it's about the intensity. Also, you might not want to look at it. We typically talk about a spectrum, don't we? And that's what the medical professionals will talk about. I was looking at something a guy on LinkedIn was doing, and he describes it more of a bubble. If you think about a bubble, and there's all these different traits in there, and all of us might have some of them, but neurodiverse people are kind of more concentrated in certain areas, but it's a much more flexible way of looking at it rather than, are you on this end of the spectrum or that end of the spectrum? Because then you have to say, well, then there's normal somewhere in the middle. Well, you can't. And neuroscience is now ahead of the medics, if you like, because neuroscience is now understanding that we've actually got, if you look at the different neurodiverse conditions, it's not necessarily very helpful to dissect them all. It's more about looking at this different way of processing information and interacting with people than it is, well, you know, she's got dyspraxia, so she's got some issues with movement, and he's got autism, so he gets very kind of focused on one thing. It's much more complex than that. And interestingly, and you touched on it earlier about situations. It's situation dependent. So we are disabled. I don't feel like I have a disability, but in some environments I am disabled. And the brain is so complex that if you look at dyslexia in English speaking people as against dyslexia in Chinese speaking people, different parts of the brain are going on here. So don't ask me to explain all the neuroscience behind that, but it's quite complex. You know, we can't say, sometimes people want to know exactly what's happening with autism. Well, there isn't an exact. If you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. You've probably heard that phrase. You could use the same phrase for any other condition. It's complex. So the point is always in the work I do that people will perhaps tell me their diagnosis, and that's good for me to know. But quite soon, let's put that to one side. What's going on for you? How are you experiencing the world? And that's the starting point to go from.
Can you tell me what your vision is of the ideal workplace?
Oh, gosh, the ideal workplace. I think the ideal workplace would be where anyone, no matter whether neurodiverse, neurotypical, is helped to understand how they work at their best. Now, and some typical examples might be, and it'll depend who you are, it's okay to put some noise-cancelling headphones on without people thinking I'm being rude, because in this moment now, I just can't deal with all of this, so I need to concentrate, for example. It's okay for me to print something out rather than to try and absorb all that information on screen, and I get my highlighter out and put different colours on something so I can categorise and understand something. Or I have a headboard, or it's okay for me to just do this kind of research because that's where I excel, or it's okay for me to be able to do a few things at once because that's how I'm most effective. You could go on forever. You have to take into consideration what the organization is trying to achieve. But I mean, there is so much research now about how much more productive you are as a company if you embrace diversity. And we know that if you look at gender diversity, we know that if we look at ethnicity, because then you are responding to your whole, you know, customer base as well. And if you all only have the same type of people and adhere to systems for those types of people, you're going to be missing out on a lot of creativity and a lot of new ideas and, you know, how to stay ahead of the competition. It's about having a conversation. So anyone in the workplace needs to be able to think they can have a conversation, because actually, I mean, there is technology, there's software, there's all sorts of things like that. But generally, reasonable adjustments aren't very costly if you have a conversation. It's about how people do things.
If now somebody listens who knows or thinks they're neurodiverse, how would you advise them? How would you suggest that they start that conversation at the workplace?
That's a tricky one, because it depends on the workplace you're in. Some people are very worried about disclosing what their condition is, because of the bias that there is. If you've got a manager that you think you can have a conversation with, I would say it's about, look, I either do have this condition, or I'm pretty sure I have, and from what I know and I've heard recently, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I've got lots of strengths. I'd like to be able to use them more effectively. And in order to do that, I think I'm going to need your help. Mm-hmm. That would be how I would do it, if you're in the right place to do it. But I do understand. See, for example, when people are applying for jobs, there's all this, well, please let us know if you have a disability. Some people don't trust that because they've been, you know, it hasn't worked for them in the past. So we think we've got a long way to go as a society to make sure that people are able to disclose that, because as you mentioned, of the stigma around it. But in an ideal world, it would be good if you could describe not your disability, but your superpowers. This is what I can bring to the company, given the right environment. I don't think I've got the definitive answer to that. And I do want to recognise that it's not necessarily that easy. But the more we can focus on the strengths collectively over time, the better it will be.
One thing is, maybe your manager isn't open to the idea, or you have a feeling that he or she isn't open to the idea. How about talking to a colleague?
Yes. That's another idea.
Is that learning, building that muscle about talking about it?
I like that analogy, building that muscle, because the more you explore it and the more you start to understand where your strengths are and the more you can articulate it, and the less processing you're having to do. That's another strategy you can use. If you're neurodiverse and you've got a lot of information coming in, start working out what you can do in advance to create the right environment so that in the moment you don't have to process a lot. Mm-hmm. So that can be about rehearsing. It can be about state management. There's all sorts of things you can do to reduce the possibility of you getting overwhelmed, mm-hmm. So that your strengths, so they're free to emerge, I suppose. And just one other thing is, I mean, it's taken me a long time to be comfortable with this. I always used to be really afraid of going on video because I was aware that I'm not a typical communicator. So I can talk a bit fast and I'm quite mobile. I mean, I don't know how apparent it's been today, but you've probably seen me kind of looking up and moving around. Whereas I know, you know, if you're properly trained, in, you'd be able to sit very still and talk very kind of in an organized way. And I know that because I actually have a little bit of Tourette's as well. It doesn't impact my life, but so I know I blink sometimes, and now I'm blinking more because it's auto-suggestible. And all of these things in the past, I thought people are going to think I'm really weird. I don't think that now. I'm just me. So be confident in yourself. Yeah. You are who you are. You are enough.
Yeah, because that's really a nice sentence. Be comfortable in who you are. And I think for people who bring something different to the table, being more honest and upfront, because hiding away and trying to make everybody else feel comfortable, nah. If we want to come to
get you very far.
Yeah, and if we want to come to your vision of the workplace, well, then we just have to bring all those things to the table and say, well, look, this is me.
I know, and if I can't be authentic in this role, well, that would be really bad. It actually reminds me of the poem by Marianne Williamson that was read out at Nelson Mandela's inauguration. And there's a line in there about who are we to withhold our strengths? Those aren't the exact words, in the hope that other people won't be disturbed or something like that. I'll send it to you. It's very inspiring. That's, if you like, shifting the emphasis, especially for Brits. You know, we can be, oh no, I don't want to appear boastful, those kind of things. It's not about that at all. It's about, look, if the world needs what we can offer, we need to make that clear. But you need, like you said earlier, you need to practice that and own it.
Mm-hmm. And be just comfortable also with the people who aren't quite there yet to accept it. And
yes, acceptance is really, really important.
You know, but for that, we need to be honest. Claire, at the end of every podcast, and whoever listened to any of the whole episodes, and I hope you have too, there's my favorite question at the end. And that is, was there a question that you had hoped I would ask you and I didn't? Or was there something where you say, well, you know, that is for me the most important thing. I would really like to underline that.
In anticipation that people were thinking, oh, superpowers, I put together something which your listeners or your viewers can have. And I think you're going to send that link. It's just a bit of a summary of what the medics define as these different conditions, what they then say are the kind of where they start off with the weaknesses, but actually the magic then, if you look at the third column there, is what might the superpowers be? It's just a starting point. You know, I'd like to spend a lot more time on it. And also, I think you're going to share a link if anybody wants to find out a bit more. very happy to have a what's called a discovery conversation. You don't even need to be wanting to be doing coaching. I'm happy to have an initial conversation. And then the point about the key message is, look, it's never too late. It's taken me, and nothing is wasted, because I worked in quite successfully in retail, talent development, organizational development, but always during those years, it was, oh, I'm going to be found out. And then I moved into the coaching, because my natural bent with the empathy was to help people really use their strengths. And now I found my home, if you like, my niche, because I both got the professional and business experience and the lived experience. It doesn't mean that I know all the answers. It's more about asking the right questions, but it's never too late. I'm 61, I think. Yes, I'm 61. And I don't want to give up working. I might want to maybe work a bit less. But it's so satisfying when you can see people run with who they really are. Mm-hmm. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to share this.
So Claire, thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure.
And talking about neurodiversity and spreading some light on the challenges that are out there and giving an inkling of what somebody can do when either in their family, in their team, or themselves, they have an idea they might fall into that part of the bubble. I go now with bubble. Thank you, Claire.
You heard a production by Anja Förster. Copyright Anja Förster. Music by Audionautics.com.